Hello, everybody, and welcome to The Rest is History. Tom, we seem to do nothing these days but record episodes of The Rest is History.
I know. Occasionally, you get an hour where we're not recording an episode of The Rest is History. Yeah. And I just sit there not knowing what to do. Kind of.
Theo's written a list. Since our last bonus, this is what we've done. We did an episode on Gladiators. We did an episode on Pompeii. We did Love Island 2 with your daughter, Katie. We did the Library of Alexandria. We did the Taj Mahal. And we did China in the era of Deng Xiaoping. That's quite a lot.
Yeah, I know.
That's a lot of range, Tom.
There is a lot of range there.
And while we've been doing that, in the hours when we haven't been doing that, I've been reading up on British fascism.
So I'm about to go off and do an event in picturesque Buxton in Derbyshire. So I'll be sitting on a train. So I'm going to be reading about British fascists on the train.
Great.
Hurrah for the Black Shirts, it's called, isn't it?
Yeah, Martin Pugh. It's a very good book.
And where does that title come from?
Well, Tom, we're going to be talking about this. So not all, well, people didn't know what we now know about the fascist movement, I think it's fair to say.
Right.
And, you know, there were elements of the British media that saw the Black Shirts as a corrective to what they saw as the corruption of parliamentary democracy. We will be having to be talking about this.
So it's the Daily Mail.
In the episodes, yeah.
The now, Daily Mail, just to repeat that.
Tom, I mean, if you want to open the paper and find a double page spread, Tom Holland, how much the school fees were at your previous educational establishment, the estimated price of your house, neighbors say, you know, strange noises coming from the basement, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Photoshopped pictures.
There would never be Photoshopped pictures in the Daily Mail, okay. Tom. I just want to be absolutely on record about that.
Okay, so yeah, so there are lots and lots of episodes booked in, stacked up like planes waiting to land at an overcrowded airport. And among those planes, of course, is Viking Sorcery, which was due to come out, 2 weeks' time or something? And then we've shoveled it back, and then we've pushed it back even further. And I saw that you suggested never putting it out. I mean, it's a great episode. It's a really good episode.
It's a good episode.
There is no reason why it's been delayed. I mean, there's no sinister reason at all.
No.
But I kind of like the idea of the mystique of it.
I agree. Because I think now it's bound to be a disappointment. No. Because it was a very good episode. It is a good episode. If you like Vikings and if you like kind
sorcery,
and medieval magic and religion.
Shamans.
Then this is absolutely the podcast for you. However, it now carries the weight of expectation, doesn't it? So yeah, Neil Price was our guest. He did nothing wrong. He was a perfectly good guest. He was a very good guest. But almost it's become a kind of joke, hasn't it, when we have the planning meetings. We're like, we'll bump Viking Sorcery.
Oh, we can't. Oh, let's move Viking Sorcery.
Yeah.
But that is coming.
So Stephen Clark was tweeting me yesterday. Stephen Clark, a great friend of The Rest is History from the very beginning. History teacher himself, of course. Stephen Clark said, are we going to do a big series for Napoleon, for the film?
Have you seen the trailer?
Yeah, I have.
I don't know how they can possibly have squeezed it all in. The film must go on for about 7 days.
No, I think they're obviously going to really compress it, which is a shame. It'd be better off as a series.
But they seem to go right the way up to Russia.
Russia, they go to the end, I think. They go to Waterloo.
But it begins with the guillotining of Marie Antoinette.
Yeah.
And up to Waterloo, and they're going to do it in 2 hours.
The problem with that is then it just becomes a series of vignettes, doesn't it? And there's no...
There was a wonderful shot of Napoleon in Egypt.
Yeah.
Sitting in front of the Sphinx, like the famous painting.
But how long is he going to be in Egypt for in the film? About 4 minutes.
Yeah.
No, Stephen Clark said, are you going to do a series for Napoleon when the film comes out? And I said, no, we're not. And then it was like, oh, perturbation and despair, very francophobic, not doing a series on Napoleon. And actually the reason, Tom, is that we are scheduled up. You know, we don't have room to shove in a load of Napoleon when we're doing the assassination of Kennedy.
No, let's just refine that, because we are scheduled up. But one of the things that we've scheduled is a massive series on the French Revolution, which will then set us up for Napoleon. So we're looking to the long term. I mean, we're looking forward to 2030, 2033. We might reach the Battle of Waterloo in, 2036 or something?
Yeah.
Unlike Ridley Scott shoving it all into 2 hours, we're going to take our time.
Well, we did shove the French Revolution into 1 hour.
I know we did, but we've learned our lesson. This is going to be slow Napoleonic wars.
Yeah, we'll do it properly. We'll do Napoleon's entire career, but we'll do it, you know, in great detail. It would be weird to do Napoleon rushed out just for the film.
And chiefly through the prism of British victories, I think.
Very good. Well, it's funny because Andrew Roberts, who is usually the most patriotic British historian, sometimes, Napoleon the Great, to the point of parody, absolutely worships Napoleon, which I always think is a bad sign because people who worship Napoleon, people like Conrad Black worship Napoleon. And often they turn out to be rampaging egotists. Yeah, to be rotters. So, of course, I wouldn't dream of saying that about Andrew Roberts, Lord Roberts of Belgravia, as he is now.
Sticking up for George III, the Patriot King.
Yeah.
Talking of which, we've got lots of questions about the American Revolution.
Do you want to make a start on the American Revolution? So, okay. Go on. You want to ask a question?
Okay, so Albion Will, he sounds neutral. A question I've always wondered about the American Revolution. One of the revolutionary slogans was no taxation without representation. Did London ever consider giving the colonies representation in Parliament, calling their bluff, as it were, or would that have opened up too much of a can of worms with regards to other colonial possessions? Thanks.
You're welcome. Realistically, I think no. There were people who talked about it, absolutely. So there were people who said, well, could there not be some solution with colonial MPs? The problem, of course, is that this is an unreformed Parliament. So this is a Parliament with kind of the classic kind of 18th century rotten boroughs. It's also one of two parliaments, by the way. So, of course, there is an Irish parliament at the same time that meets in Dublin.
But much easier to cross the Irish Sea than the Atlantic, obviously.
Of course. I suppose the truth of the matter is it would have solved absolutely nothing. Because when people talk about the no taxation without representation line, they sometimes, I think, do so under the assumption that if you fix the second part of that equation, as it were, then the first part falls neatly into place. In other words, oh, well, you give them representation, you have an MP for Boston, Massachusetts, and then it's fine. But obviously, it's not fine. What the colonists want, they do not want to be drawn more deeply into the British governing system. Quite the reverse. They want the British governing system to get out and to leave them alone. So actually, the idea that you could, you know, say, okay, well, let's have 30 MPs come over to London. I mean, just you could reasonably say that's going to be very difficult because how is it even going to work? They're going to vote on things without possibly being able to consult opinion back in the colonies. But then, what if they're outvoted on a tax bill? There's taxation for, and they are outvoted time and again. So actually, I don't think it would have even remotely have worked.
But it didn't work in the 20th century, did it? I mean, it's not as though Australia or New Zealand or Canada or South Africa, I mean, most notoriously, were sending MPs to Westminster. The whole question of how the Dominions were to be integrated into a parliamentary democracy. I mean, this is the great rub of British imperialism. How can you have an empire and a parliamentary democracy? What's the name of the American scholar who wrote a book about the British Empire being terribly evil? And saying that...
Elkins?
Yes.
Caroline Elkins?
That's right, yes. Saying that it's precisely the show of liberalism that enabled the British to get away with all their evil deeds.
I'm not really convinced by Caroline Elkins's argument, I have to say.
No, but I think it does point to a tension at the heart of British imperialism throughout, that imperial dominions can't be integrated into a parliamentary democracy, even when you have better communications, even when you have telegrams and telephones and all kinds of things.
Well, I don't know about that, Tom. First of all, you could argue the Dominions actually were integrated into a parliamentary democracy. I mean, they had their own parliaments. That was the fix.
Right.
That you'd give them their own parliaments.
But that's the issue. The parliaments are geographically where the Dominion is. They're not sending MPs to Westminster.
And they're taxing themselves.
Right.
But the British are only ever going to make that decision. I mean, you only get to that place, I think, once you've had the American Revolution. You couldn't get to that place without having had it first. Does that make sense? The British were never going to adopt that.
Well, I don't know enough about how Australia obtained its parliament, but are British officials thinking, oh, we better give them a parliament or else we'll have a revolution? I doubt it's working like that.
I don't think they're thinking that, but they're thinking now this is the natural thing to do. They have in their minds the example of the American Revolution. You know, that's the first time there has been any form of colonial conflict of this kind.
But I would say that it's more that they are wrestling with the inherent contradictions of an imperial power being a liberal democracy and arriving at a conclusion that is perhaps easier to arrive at in an age of kind of mass suffrage in the 20th century than it is in the 18th century.
Well, the 19th century is when they get in there.
Yeah.
Is when they start making the steps.
But the idea that dominion status can be a stepping stone to independence is a 20th century idea, I think, isn't it? Maybe it's brewing there in the 19th century. I don't know.
I think it's brewing there in the 19th century. I think one thing we haven't talked about at all, actually it's something I'd love to do on the podcast, although it's probably a niche subject, so Thea would, you know, raise an eyebrow at it. Obviously, Spain has lost all its colonies at that point. At the point at which Britain is granting, is moving towards dominion status for Australia, Canada, New Zealand, and so on. So it's not just that Britain lost the American colonies. It's also that Spain and Portugal lost their incredibly lucrative South and Central American colonies. So you've got lots of examples now of European powers that actually can make a mess of things. And so I think Britain is...
But the difference is that we're talking about settler colonies.
Yeah.
We're talking Australia, New Zealand, Canada.
Which is what the Spanish colonies are, by the way. Argentina, for example.
But not Mexico, not Brazil. Not
no, that's true.
Peru.
That's true. Although the elites are settlers.
Sure. But that's the case in Rhodesia and Kenya.
Just to go back to your point about parliaments, actually. So there is an interesting road not taken. We've sort of slightly gone off piste and we're not really talking about America, but we're talking about the British Empire more generally. And that's Joseph Chamberlain, a politician that I find unbelievably interesting, former mayor of Birmingham, who becomes the sort of guiding spirit of the British Empire in the 1890s, 1900s. His dream was of an imperial federation. And he wanted the various parliaments, including the parliament in Britain, in the long run probably, to be subordinate to an imperial parliament.
But where would that imperial parliament meet?
Well, presumably in London. This would have been the sort of, you know, Star Wars Galactic Empire scenario where the outlying systems are all indelibly part of a single entity, which is the British Empire.
But it still doesn't work.
Well, it didn't happen.
I know, but it would never have worked for the same reason we've been discussing. That if you're, you know, if MPs are coming over from, I don't know, Sydney.
Yeah.
Well, that's a long way.
In the days of the telegraph, though, they can telegraph home and have instructions from home very quickly. So logistically, it actually could work. But I think the bigger issue is that, of course, over time, the different parts of the empire, let's take Australia as an example, they're going to have different economic and strategic interests from Britain. They may still be very closely allied. You know, they may have all the ties of kith and kin, all that stuff. But, you know, they're going to start pulling apart.
And there's a slight sense of that strain in constitutional debates about the United Kingdom at the moment. I mean, it's a slight... I think that's what the SNP would argue.
Oh, that Scotland and England have diametrically opposed. Yeah.
Erroneously.
Well,
but they argue it all the same.
The SNP's, it's interesting, isn't it, Tom? Because I know you've been a great scourge of the SNP. I mean, well, or
scourge.
They might regard you as more of a gnat. I don't know.
Yes.
But, their moment has, at least for the time being, their moment has passed, hasn't it?
They're now, of course, wrestling with their own secessionist crisis.
Orkney.
The people of Orkney want to claim independence, which is very funny.
Yeah. Want to join Norway.
Or be a crown dependency.
Presumably you'd rather be a crown dependency because that's really having your cake and eating it, isn't it, in terms of options?
Yeah. I think being a crown dependency is fabulous.
Yeah, because you can basically be a tax haven.
Exactly.
Which is the dream of all small islands.
Yes. Right. Anyway, look, we've sorted out all kinds of things there.
So to go back to your question, I don't think there was some talk of it, Albion Will, but... I do not think there was ever a plausible outcome that involved 25 or 30 or however many American colonial members of parliament taking their seats in Westminster and that solving the problem. I don't think that was ever going to happen.
Right. Okay. Well, that's put to bed. Now, we've got a question from Jeffrey Marr, which I think is very timely because yesterday we were talking to Rana Mitter about Deng Xiaoping. And the process by which China, in the wake of Mao's death, opened up economically, fleetingly, I suppose, to a degree, culturally as well. And part of the way in which China opened up culturally, Rana was talking about this, was a documentary series that went out about Chinese history a year before the Tiananmen Square massacre, in which it was being argued by the makers of the documentary that China was chained to its history, and it compared the Yellow River, which is 7/8 mud, 1/8 water, to the open blue seas of the ocean. So essentially saying that China had to jettison its past and blend in with the liberal order of the West, which is not the kind of film that would be made after the Tiananmen Square massacre. So this is a Jeffrey Marr's email. I'm a Chinese living in New Zealand for the past 20 years. I know how we think back in China and a little bit of how Westerners think. I don't think it's correct to see Chinese communism as the same as Soviet communism or Marxism. It makes more sense to see it as the successor of the history, culture, and philosophy since the first emperor of Qin. The fundamental principles of how this country should be ruled and how the people should be looked after haven't changed much for the past 2,000 years. Even the form of the government has always been to select elites through exams. You won't see the real China if you see it through democracy, authoritarianism, or other Western ideas. The community is always more important than the individual, and the country is always more important than the community. This is from Confucius and other ancient philosophers. I don't think that this will change, and it doesn't matter what government is in power. So we were kind of discussing that with Rana, weren't we? The degree, I mean, Rana's very interesting and kind of sophisticated in his take on the deep roots of modern day China, and that it lies not just in communism, but in the politics and the culture of the imperial period.
Yeah.
And actually, just before we were starting, we were debating whether it would be interesting to do a podcast on the deep history of China, the beginnings of China, how China begins. You pulled a face and you're now pulling that face again.
No, I'm not. That's an absolute lie. I can't believe you'd say something so
cruel. Why are you pulling a face? We were talking about it and you poo-pooed it.
That's my face. That is...
The wind had changed.
No, I think the truth of the matter is, these days you can't really get away with making remarks like that about people's faces. I think it's
okay,
it speaks to your old fashioned and sometimes frankly reactionary.
Dominic, you were pulling a face.
I tell you what, we didn't really talk about that as much as we could have done with Rana. Let's be blunt about it. You said when you introduced him, you said, you know, we'll be talking about Deng Xiaoping and the revival of China, and we'll be looking at the deep history of it. But actually, we never really got into it.
Because we were running out of time by that.
Because we ran out of time. And I think...
That's a problem.
I know nothing at all about Chinese history, by the way. But that won't stop me opining now.
Go for it.
So it's a little bit like when we talked about Russia before. There was this slight sense in Western kind of popular histories. Oh, well, it's Russia. You know, they love autocracy. It's a different place. Deep traditions. And it becomes overly deterministic. And maybe my pushback against Jeffrey's question would be that the fundamental principles haven't changed for 2,000 years, Confucianism. That's a classic thing that Westerners say about China, though, isn't it, Tom? I mean, Jeffrey Marr's not a Westerner, but Westerners do say that.
I'm not sure it is. I think that the debate about China is often kind of framed around, certainly it was in the kind of the later years of Deng Xiaoping's rule, and, you know, the years that immediately followed his death, was, you know, is China going to become a democracy? Is it going to liberalize? Is the trade liberalization, the economic liberalization going to feed into cultural liberalization? And so it was entirely framed within Western paradigms. Mm-hmm. And I think that's inevitable because we have paradigms that we apply to other countries. I mean, the thing about China is, of course, that the Chinese themselves are the people who are most aware of their deep past.
Yeah.
It's part of the fabric of the country. And that's what the Cultural Revolution was basically about. There wouldn't have been needed to be a Cultural Revolution if there wasn't a culture that had to be chucked out.
But Tom, do you not think, though, if I was saying to you, I mean, you know, well, when people write about England, it's deep past, Brexit, they've been the same for 2,000 years.
No, but nobody says that.
A lot of people would roll their eyes and say, come on, that's ridiculous. I mean, that's...
But it's akin to me arguing that we are determined by kind of cultural strains of DNA, so the Christian stuff, for instance.
Oh no, not that again, Tom.
Yeah, but
don't, it's all right. I'm just getting my own back for your meanness about my face.
But that would be my riposte, is that culture is very deeply rooted.
Yeah.
And that it's difficult to change things like that. That even if you abolish the empire or religion or whatever in China, it keeps coming back.
Tom, do you know what? I don't really disagree with you. Clearly, there are deep continuities in history. I mean, actually, when I was just thinking when we first read Jeffrey Marr's question about, I do know nothing about China, but reading Stephen Kotkin's masterful books about Stalin, and one of the fascinating things is that he really has his cake and eats it in these books. So on the one hand, he sees Stalin as somebody who's a real Marxist true believer, and he says You don't understand Stalin, you don't understand the terror and all that without absolutely taking seriously this sense of the revolutionary possibilities and the utopianism and all that stuff. And yet at the same time, one of the reasons his books are so long is because he says Stalin is the heir to the Tsars. And this geopolitical challenges the Tsars faced, Russian culture, he's obviously been a seminarian, orthodoxy. You know, people bear the weight of history. So I agree with you to some degree.
But I think also that there's a degree of geographical determinism as well. So the fact that China is begins as a riverine civilization, how important is that? The nature of the food staples that they have, I don't know enough about it to say whether this is important. But
come on, Tom, talk to us about Chinese food staples.
Well, the fact that it's rice. So are there kind of do you need a kind of collective enterprise to make the rice fields work? I suspect you probably do. And that's something that goes right the way back to the beginnings of agricultural civilization in China. I just think it's an interesting topic.
This is good stuff.
We don't know enough about it, but that's why I am scoping around to try and find someone who might come and be able to talk about this.
I think, Tom, you have demonstrated something that I was saying to you before we even started recording. So in the last 30 seconds or so, you've borne out the point that I made, which is that you can do this yourself.
Right.
Your knowledge of Chinese rice culture is second to none.
I feel that, you know, when you get a kind of an interest in something.
Yeah.
And it's like kind of tickling at the back of your throat when you feel a cold coming on.
Right.
I do increasingly feel that about ancient China.
Crikey.
The problem is I don't speak a word of Chinese, so.
Okay, well, that's never stopped you in the past. So.
I think that's a little harsh, Dominic, a little harsh.
No, I'm saying it hasn't stopped you. If I'd said it had stopped you, Tom, and has hamstrung your work, that would be a very different matter. But I don't think it has.
Yeah, but I wouldn't write about the Romans if I hadn't, you know, couldn't read Latin.
Okay.
So I would be nervous about doing China.
And your Arabic still a tip-top form?
Yeah, so my Arabic was a problem. But, we talked about this before, that I had to have a Syriac-speaking Arab do all the translations for me.
Yeah.
And it was a tremendous hassle. And I don't think I could do that with China.
Okay. Susan Bond, excitingly, Susan E. Bond has been associated with the subject of my PhD dissertation, Tom.
Oh, wonderful.
She volunteered for the Eugene McCarthy campaign in Racine, Wisconsin, as a college freshman. He had just won New Hampshire. We were very excited to be helping him. I remember watching Lyndon Johnson make the announcement he wouldn't run again. We thought we'd won the lottery. Paul Newman was there. It was pretty heady stuff. I guess it's too late to put this in your dissertation. It is a bit late to put it in the dissertation, but it's a lovely story nonetheless. So
now I'm wondering if Susan E. Bond is the very distinguished religious scholar. I wonder if it is.
Wow.
If it is, thank you, Susan. We're honored to have you.
If she's that distinguished, I can't believe she's sat through the previous 25 minutes of this.
And if it's not you, Susan, then it doesn't make any difference. We're still, thank you very much for your question.
She joined to hear serious religious scholarship, and actually she found herself listening to you opine about Chinese rice collection.
I think, Dominic,
that
as a materialist, you surely recognize the importance of food staples.
I do. I'm just genuinely amused at you actually carrying off, I think, pretty well.
Thank you. It's back to basics, Dominic.
Yeah. So let's do some other questions. Misty Mulvaner, who we met at the Athelstan party, at least I did. If you could break away from history for a minute, what subject would you like to discuss, Tom, on another podcast?
Well, there are two subjects I've already discussed on other podcasts. So I have discussed dinosaurs.
I knew he was going to say this.
And I have discussed cricket.
Yeah. I answered this on the Discord, which, you know, we recommend to you to do your chatting on if you're not already on it. Chat community. Somebody on Twitter said to me,
chat community.
Somebody on Twitter said to me,
say it again.
I would pay anything so that I no longer have to hear you use the word chat community. And I said, well, it's very simple. You just join up to the chat community and then you never have to hear those words again. So I already replied to Mr. Morvan and I said, I would like to talk about football and I would talk about fiction, Tom. The novels.
Yes, you love your fiction, don't you?
I do love my fiction.
You're the only man in Britain who still reads novels.
Apparently so. It's extraordinary, actually, how resistant middle-aged men are to reading fiction. Do you not think?
We've moved on.
Yeah, sad. Sad. Lack of imagination. Right. Here's a question for you. S.W. Jacobs, prompted by the enthusiasm for signed copies of PAX, when did this idea of secular relics start, i.e. signed copies of books, autographs, napkins? It all seems positively sacral. That's a good question for you, Tom.
I don't really know.
There was definitely a trade in Napoleon souvenirs.
And Byron, yeah. But does it go back earlier? There's definitely Boswell is kind of buying into that. He's going around and meeting famous men.
Yeah.
Talking to Rousseau on the toilet and things. You know, if he'd had a phone, he would definitely have taken selfies.
The relics of Charles I after his execution.
But that's kind of religious, isn't it?
It is religious.
He's a martyr. They're dipping handkerchiefs into his blood and things.
Interesting. I would say probably...
18th century, I would guess.
These things are commercially driven, really, aren't they? I mean, the idea of secular relics. I'm guessing 18th century, I'd agree with you.
I mean, the thing about Boswell is that he's going to see Rousseau and Voltaire.
Yeah.
And they are skeptical about received religious. You know, they're rejecting Catholicism with its relics.
Yeah.
I mean, there may be, maybe it's a Protestant counterpoint to Catholic relics. I don't know. Who knows? There must be books on this.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I think it's a product of the 18th century because it's an age of collecting. It's also an age of tourism. So you can move around and get the relics. You know, you can go to Rome and get coins or get whatever.
People love death masks, don't they?
Yeah. Oliver Cromwell's death mask is in the Ashmolean in Oxford. I shall be seeing it tomorrow, Tom.
So how did that come to survive?
I don't know. Just don't know.
So somebody must have kept it.
It's not a thing we often admit on this podcast, but there are limits to our knowledge, aren't there?
No, it's a very good question, and maybe something we should investigate. Or if people can have thoughts, if they know the answer to that question, let us know. Among our, what is it, chat community.
Handle with Claire asks if you have a favourite relic. Tom, do you have a favourite relic? Your coins, I suppose. Your coin collection, are they relics?
Yeah. I mean, I like collecting things.
Yeah.
I have a signed wedding photo from Ian Botham. What about you?
To link to the Susan E. Bond, when I was doing my PhD, Eugene McCarthy's, the archives of his 1968 campaign from Georgetown, and they were just all dumped and uncatalogued in these boxes. And this bloke who was the archivist said to me, you can just go in and like basically help yourself. Go in and like root around. There's no catalogue. You know, they were quite lax by the standards of archives. And so I did. I would bring out these boxes and there would be, in the box, there would be 1,000 Eugene McCarthy themed matchboxes. Or
you could just stuff like that. One.
Well, I said to him, do you need all these matchboxes? He said, oh, no, for the point of the archive, you know, there's no difference between us having 998 Eugene McCarthy matchboxes. And so I did. And actually, on Catherine's instructions, I threw them all away when we bought our house.
So when I went to Wyoming, I was doing a feature for the Sunday Times about an excavation there on a vast Jurassic fossil bed. And the bones were just dropping off the side of the mountain. You know, this kind of rock face.
Tom, don't say anything that will get you barred from re-entering the United States.
No, I'm not going to, but I'm going to show my incredible fortitude. This great lump of bone marrow, fossilized bone marrow, dropped at my feet. It would have been so easy just to pick it up, zip it in my pocket, and I resisted the temptation.
What a good person.
Yes. So if there's anyone from American immigration listening to that, I just want that put on the record.
What a good person he is. Yeah.
Yes.
Extraordinary.
Incredible self-discipline.
Chris of Mercia, if you were commissioned to write an updated version of A Distant Mirror by Barbara Tuchmans, that's the, you know, very successful popular history book about the 14th century, isn't it, Tom? Which past age would you choose to reflect our present troubled times and why?
Well, I can answer that because I've already done it. That's why I wrote Rubicon, which is about the fall of the Roman Republic and the involvement of an imperial republic in Middle Eastern wars. And I wrote that against the backdrop of the build-up to the invasion of Iraq.
So when did you start writing Rubicon?
I started that in 2000.
Pre-September the 11th?
Pre-September the 11th, but it was a kind of era of absolute American preponderance. The imperial republic... the sense that this was a fascinating parallel.
Yeah.
And then I remember I was writing about a massacre of Roman businessmen, Italian businessmen, that was staged by Mithridates, the king of Pontus, mm-hmm. on the day that 9/11 happened. And from that point on, so much of what I was writing about the Republic was being kind of echoed in the news. So I would spend all day writing, then I'd stop at 5 because I'd have to go and pick up Katie, who was, she was 3 or 4 at that point. From across the road. And then I'd kind of get her tea ready and everything and put her to bed while listening to the news in the background. and it would feel like the news was a running commentary on what I've been writing about. Now, I think to a degree, I might have been slightly over-persuaded by that, but it was very vivid. And I was very, and when I reread Rubicon, which I had to do a few years ago to write an introduction to a new edition, you know, I'd put in titles like
Caesar's War on Terror.
War on Terror.
Yeah. I remember
Known
that.
Unknowns, things like that.
Yeah.
So I also remember a passage I wrote about the Athenians joining up to a Roman war and playing the role of Tony Blair, you know, that they they could put into fluent oratory the case that the Romans needed to be made. And there were kind of all these little echoes and nudges that I put in. And it seemed as much a book about the early 21st century as it did about the Roman Republic, actually.
Well, all books are like that. Even in White Heat, I think I've got a chapter about called Desperate Housewives. And I thought that was quite funny at the time when I wrote it in about 2005.
But now, that doesn't mean anything to anyone.
Yeah, exactly.
So the dangers of doing that was something that was very present in my mind when I was writing Pax. I wanted to make the Roman world seem as different as possible from the present
right.
world. That was so kind of constant revision.
So, last question.
Can we have Stephen Clark's last question?
Look at that, Tom. That a question for an elite podcaster like yourself. Do you get worse pre-match nerves before a podcast with a guest you really respect? A podcast where the topic is a long way from your specialism, Chinese rice, a live show before a large audience, or before the publication of one of your books?
I always think the publication of a book is the most nerve-wracking, don't you? Because it's so public. It's like having your job review where all your friends and family can see it. It's horrible.
I mean, I think it's fair to say, isn't it, Tom? I'm speaking for myself. Yeah. I mean, you could really surprise me now, and you could say something that has surprised me more than anything else you've ever said. But I would be staggered if you said you got pre-match nerves before a podcast. No, the very idea is so implausible and ludicrous. No, we would never be. I mean, no matter who the guest, we'd never be nervous before a podcast.
It's not exactly nervousness, but maybe a nervous energy when I have to talk about something that I'm supposed to know a lot about. So we just did two episodes derived from PAX, which really I ought to know everything about.
Yeah.
But because I ought to know everything about it, you kind of feel, oh, but what if I get something wrong? What if I miss something out? And in a way, those are the worst to do, I think, oddly.
A bit. Well, that's the issue, that you know too much.
It frees you up
when you know so little. So I wasn't nervous before doing the Costa Rican Civil War because I thought, I know five things about the Costa Rican Civil War, four of which are probably wrong. Nobody is possibly expecting us to know anything about it. Yeah. We'll just crack on, do the podcast, have a laugh, and then it's the Costa Rican Civil War. The stakes are so low, as it were, for us doing the podcast. So we can really enjoy it. And of course, you know, we don't want to get anything wrong, but I think it's true to say that there are some things that will attract more attention and that we're more, but we don't get nervous before. But it's one of the great pleasures about doing it from home, actually, isn't it? That we do it because you're doing it in your own environment. I mean, I've got Arthur downstairs right now, you know, who's waiting for me to go and, you know, give him a cake or something. So that means that it doesn't feel like you're on stage because you're doing it from your own, in your own environment. The live shows are slightly different, aren't they? I mean, you've got 2,000 people.
I felt a bit nervous before the very first one we did, the one in Drury Lane, because it was such a big theatre.
I think what makes me nervous is when my co-presenter says 5 minutes before the show, I think we should completely
redo it,
rip up the structure, and then uses the terrible and chilling phrase, Theo, who is the produced this episode, will be amused by this because I remember his face at the time when he heard that this phrase had been used. Total podcasting. Remember that?
Yes, I
do. So a bit like total football from the 1970s, yes. Johan Cruyff's
just
and the Dutch.
Moving all over the pitch.
Which is that there's no structure. There's no plan. At any moment, we could talk about anything. And as Theo was writing in the chat, every producer's dream. So in other words, Theo was armed for the live show with, like, I don't know, 15 slides or something. And the agreement was that we would talk about these subjects in this or particular order so Theo would know at what point to flash up the slide on the screen.
But I wasn't hearing any of that.
And Tom's suggestion 5 minutes before we start was we rip that up and Theo would just, we could talk about
just
whatever
have to
we
keep
like.
Keep him on his toes.
Theo would have to do free form slide selection. Yeah. To match whatever we were talking about. So I think when you publish a book, I absolutely agree with you. It is much more exposing than even doing a TV series, I would say, because, you know, I would do TV series and be slightly nerving myself for the reviews, sometimes good, sometimes shocking.
But they're so ephemeral, aren't they? They're out and then they're gone.
But they're very ephemeral. No one ever looks up the reviews of an old TV series. Plus, a TV series is by nature a collaborative effort. And some things that the reviewer may greatly like or dislike may be nothing to do with you at all. So it's hard to take it so personally. Even if they're saying, he looks like this, he does this, you may think, well, they just use the wrong takes. It's not my fault. Whereas with a book, it's so exposing. And if somebody says you can't write,
it's very depressing.
Well, I can't believe anyone ever said that about you, Tom. But when people mock your prose, I think that's the worst, isn't it? People mock you. I mean, I don't think you've ever had that, surely.
No.
But I'm always very conscious that as a, you know, somebody who's written hundreds upon hundreds of book reviews, I'm in no, I can't allow myself to worry about it because...
You're in a large glass house.
Correct. If you dish it out, you absolutely have to be prepared to take it. But also you have to know, doesn't really matter. I mean, I always remember, it's a bit like, it's just like that story that you told, Tom, that I think is so... It really resonated with me, the story about when you were in the eye of the storm about your documentary that you made about the origins of Islam, and you met an old friend who said, oh, what's been going on?
Yeah, no idea.
I remember meeting people the day after I'd had a bad review of one of my early books. And, you know, it was like, this is going to ruin the day. And my friend hadn't read it, the review. And then when I said, he said, oh, that's funny, you know. Everyone who knows, no one will think worse of you. Everyone will be delighted. All your friends will be delighted you've had a bad review and think it's immensely amusing. You know, it's, and I sort of thought, yeah, that is what they'll think. They'll be amused by it for a week.
But the problem is your enemies as well.
Yeah, but your enemies are going to hate you, whatever.
I know.
Yeah, I don't think you can. You want your enemies to be discombobulated, Tom. I mean, obviously, we're not the kind
of
people.
You want to drive your chariot over the smouldering wreckage of their city.
You do, but you will. You are. Yeah, so what are you complaining about? Right, and on that bombshell, which makes us look such lovely people, Tom, that we...
It does, doesn't it?
Yeah.
What charming insight into our characters that is.
Yeah. Well, I think you should go back to your close study of Chinese rice patterns. I'm going to go back to British fascism. And you can continue fantasizing about driving your chariots over the bleeding bodies of your enemies. I obviously would never think like that.
I know, you are a shining moral example.
Exactly.
I would do well to follow.
Yeah. Right. You're going to Buxton now, Tom, aren't you?
In about a couple of hours. I'm going to have a haircut now.
Oh, lovely. Well, enjoy.
Too much information.
Yeah, much too much. All right. Bye, everybody. See you soon.
Bye-bye.